Paddy Power and the Football Show, the greatest football partnership since Diofen Heskey.
Well, he's still reeling over the Prince Harry, Meghan Markle news, but Nathan Murphy's made his way back into studio. Hello.
How are you?
How are you? Are you okay?
Well, have you updated the listeners on the latest?
Well, the palace aren't happy, I know that much.
It's escalated. Dramatically so.
It would appear that the first the Queen heard of this statement was around the same time you and I heard of this statement, Nathan.
Unbelievable.
That actually
unbelievable.
That actually is unbelievable.
Events.
That does mean it is a fracturing. That does mean things have got a bit acrimonious there, doesn't it?
I hadn't realised that we were going to be talking about it again, but I have now found the statement. So this broke at about 7 o'clock. Yeah. If anyone didn't hear, Prince Harry and... Is she princess? Is
she a princess? She is the Duchess of Sussex.
Duchess of Sussex, okay. Meghan Markle.
Yes.
Who is going to be the villain of the piece, I suspect, as the days emerge.
I would think so.
Rightly or wrongly.
She came along, she stole away our boy.
Fair play to her. Trying to change this sad old institution.
You have a statement.
So, they said, listen, we're going to take a step back. We want to go our own way. Basically said, we're going to go and get jobs. What sort of jobs, I'm not quite sure.
No.
Earn our own money. But we'll keep all the money we've had previously. Obviously, we're not going to give that back. We've done that work already, so we're going to keep that cash.
The statement said they would work to become financially independent. It's like something your 18-year-old would say to you.
I'm still working to become financially independent. Why else would we be here?
But they said they will still
fully
support the Queen. Mm.
What does that mean?
I don't know.
You know, stand by the next manager.
Get on with the statement. What do we got?
So, the Queen released her own statement. Discussions with the Duke and Duchess of Sussex are at an early stage. We understand their desire to take a different approach, but these are complicated issues that will take time to work through.
Oof.
This is like Alexis Sanchez trying to leave Arsenal.
Mm.
Like, you think you're going,
mm.
but we think you might still have something good left in you. Like, ultimately, we're probably happy for you to leave if this is the sort of shit show you're going to bring upon us.
Mm.
But it's going to be at a time of our choosing.
Questionable move to release the statement without even running it by the palace. That's all out war in my book, Nathan.
Where does that end? Like, where does it end? Where does it end? Where does it end? Do you know, I find myself listening to OTBAM of a morning on my Amazon Echo. So I'm only listening. I'm not seeing Jaron Owen in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you listen, the more Richard Cooper comes to mind.
How so?
It's just uncanny. I'd never noticed all the little twitches and things like that that were there. Little quirks in the voices.
Did you get the Richard treatment?
No, not that. It's fine. Take it as a compliment that there's nothing to rip the piss out of.
He looked at you and your broadcasting was just so smooth.
Yeah.
So textbook.
What can I?
I can't scratch this guy.
Just so dull. There's just nothing there. That's fine. That's fine. Do you want some football news? Leicester 0, Aston Villa 1.
Mm-hmm.
48 minutes gone.
I've told the listeners this about 18 times, it feels like, but go on.
Prince William, a big Aston Villa supporter. We shouldn't forget.
I think that's just stretching.
I don't know who does Prince Harry support. I'm not quite sure.
He's more of a rugby man.
He is. More like again, like, do you give up your seats in the Royal Box at Wimbledon?
No, I think he'd see that as supporting the Queen.
Because Meghan Markle and Prince William's wife were there front and centre last year, a few times.
Yeah.
She's like willing to give that up. Like, these are the perks of the job.
Do they?
That you think, like, you do sit down and sometimes you go, ah, I don't need the perks, you know, it's too much hassle. But then you're not sitting centre court Wimbledon on men's final day.
Mm.
You're sitting at home going, actually, this isn't all it was cracked up to be.
As I understand it, when King Edward, as he was then, abdicated and just spent
And let's be honest, 40, as we all understand it by watching The Crown.
Yes. Yeah. He seemed to have a fine life. I mean, you get by still being royalty, don't you? Prince Harry's a very famous man around the world. Meghan Markle, incredibly famous. I suspect if they want Wimbledon tickets, they'll be okay.
Mm. Well, what did he do? Moved to Paris? Lived in a...
Yeah. A lot of time in America as well.
Country.
Yeah.
Okay, so it'll be all right for them.
It's not just royals who sit in the royal box at Wimbledon anyway, is it?
No, Bernard Driscoll's always there.
Yeah. So HSBC ambassadors and the royal family can sit in the royal box.
So he can become a HSBC ambassador.
Do whatever he wants.
Bad news, Brian.
So do you want to say anything about this game? Leicester and Aston Villa fans eagerly awaiting your verdict.
Leicester have been all over them.
Okay.
Throughout this game. Yet, Villa lead by a goal to nil. They scored a goal. Frederik Kjaer scored in 28 minutes. Absolutely against the run of play. And then they hit the crossbar about 10 minutes later. out both of them out of absolutely nothing. Leicester have been in complete control, dominated possession, creating lots and lots of half chances, a couple of good saves by the Villa keeper, but both times Villa have gone forward, they've looked really threatening, and Jack Grealish has just been the real star on show. He tried this volley back, didn't even try it, he executed it. Throw in, hit it first time on the half volley, straight back to the centre half about 40 yards away. Just nonchalant as you like. He's been brilliant. By far and away, Villa's best player so far. Leicester, though, looked far more threatening. Very nearly got in again there, but 1-0 win away from home, first leg. Could work out very nicely for Villa.
Now, we will get to Miguel Delaney and we will get to Tom English, but first, you have some important looking documents in front of you, which I don't think are royal family statements.
Not right now. Other statements from a institution that may need change and is getting its change.
Okay.
The FAI have appointed some independent directors.
Okay.
Three of them. The fourth isn't going to be named for a few more weeks, but as expected, it was reported in the newspapers today, Roy Barrett is the independent chairperson now at the FAI. He is the managing director at Goodbody Stockbrokers, has been involved in various big companies over the last couple of decades. It was reported this morning he was considering the position, that he's quite a private individual, and this, by its nature now at the FAI, is going to be something of a public job, but he's obviously decided that he is willing to take it on. The other two women appointed to the board of the FAI's independent directors, Catherine Guy and Liz Joyce. Catherine Guy is the CEO of Autolease Fleet Management, that's Sixth Leasing, since September 2016. Prior to this, she was managing partner at Byrne Wallace, one of Ireland's largest law firms, where she was a partner for over 20 years. And Liz Joyce is the director of HR at the Central Bank, whom she joined from Pioneer Investments. She's had a lot of HR roles, so no shortage of business experience there. And
they sound like serious, very capable people.
They do. Whether there's any footballing background, I think it's probably actually irrelevant. It's what a lot of people wanted, is people who knew and had very little interest in the running of the FAI, had no connections to what was there previously. Whether this is enough, you suspect it will be, for that deal to be done, the 18 million euro rescue deal to be done with the banks and with the government over the coming weeks. The fact that the fourth hasn't been named, you can't imagine that will be an issue. Obviously, Niall Quinn's name has been thrown around again this afternoon, but it seems whoever that fourth person is maybe has a couple of matters to tie up before they can fully commit to it. But this has been a long time coming. In fact, like a fortnight ago, we were talking about maybe nobody was willing to become an independent director because there were so many question marks over the accounts and the finances and what may still emerge and accountability.
Yeah.
But they've got it done.
Well, that's good, because Sarah Keane was even floating the possibility of having to set up some kind of emergency task force whereby people wouldn't want to go in as directors, they wouldn't want to be held liable in any way for things which could still go wrong at the FAI, given that there are reports with the Gardaí. And that seemed like it might be required, but at least they've got three of the four directors in now, so that's a sign of progress. Anything else of note in the statement?
No. Roy Barrett just said, I've decided to take on the role of non-executive chairman of the FAI at this critical time because I believe the organisation has an important role to play in developing the game. Serious job of work to be done to address the very significant failures which have beset the organisation in terms of its governance and its finances. The new board will now deal with the task with urgency, working collaboratively with its stakeholders. I assume that the start of that is meeting Shane Ross as quickly as possible.
We don't quite know Niall Quinn's intentions, do we?
No. He hasn't spoken in recent weeks about the possibility of being an independent director. I know at times he wasn't particularly happy with the process that was in place around how they were recruiting the independent directors, but it does seem as though that's sort of changed because of the urgency of the situation in the last few weeks. But there was a feeling that the independent director should have nothing to do, obviously, with the previous regime, which Niall Quinn didn't have anything to do, but also really probably nothing to do with football. To just look at this cold, hard facts. How do they somehow get this organisation to survive?
And where are we on the deal with the government? Is that imminent?
There was differing reports over the last couple of days. Some sources were saying there hadn't been any negotiations since Christmas. That they weren't any closer to a deal, that maybe the government were holding off until these appointments were fully made and ratified and accepted. The other reports were that actually this could be done by the weekend, very early next week, that the banks, the government, they're not going to let. Stephen McGuinness was on OTBA yesterday saying their understanding was 99% sure that the government wouldn't let the FAI go bust, that they would come in with some sort of a rescue package.
And then UEFA will float in next week on the 14th just to say, great.
Yeah. Good job, lads. We held off. We had a great Christmas. How's things been here?
They really did hold off brilliantly, didn't they? They said, we are not coming near this. We'll see you mid-January.
Yeah, well, there's a Euro 2020 side of this as well, that whether that was been thrown out there to panic government into doing something, that like the humiliation for the country if Dublin was unable to host games at Euro 2020 would have been pretty tough to take for everybody. But UEFA, I expect, are still going to have to keep chipping in over the coming years.
I would think so. We'll come back to that story. So there we are. Three independent directors appointed to the FAI board is the breaking news this evening. We're going to turn to events at Old Trafford last night, where, frankly, the disparity between Manchester City and Manchester United has arguably never been greater, certainly with City's time in the ascendancy anyway. Miguel Delaney of the London Independent was at Old Trafford. Miguel, at 3-0, Nathan and I were watching here in studio last night, at 3-0, given the time left on the clock, given the absolute dominance that we were seeing, last night at that point had the potential to almost be a tenure ending for Solskjaer. As it transpired, he probably woke up this morning quite relieved with 3-1, full in the knowledge it should have been a whole lot worse.
Yeah, this is the thing. I mean, at half-time, it really did have the look of a sacking performance, that it could have got really, really bad. And actually, it reminded me, in its own way, of the 3-2 at the Etihad back in April 2018, when City were absolutely destroying United at half-time in the game they could have won the title with, and then United staged a second-half comeback. Obviously, United won that game. But I think there's a wider point there in that that looked like it should have been a sacking performance at half-time. Mourinho got a result that kept him on, but like, I mean, the problems were so profound in that regime that didn't really matter, and by the end of the year he was sacked. And it's difficult to escape a similar perception with Solskjaer. You know, it's incredible saying this after what was actually still a bad defeat, but that 3-1 was nowhere near as bad as it could have been, because, I mean, no matter what way you look at it at this point, it's just, it's actually incredible that United, a club like United, are persisting with this when, like, pretty much everyone, you can see this isn't really going. It'd be a massive surprise if this turned into what they're hoping, which is some sort of quasi-Ferguson situation. But I was talking to someone who works at, I put in my piece in The Independent today, I was talking to someone who works at Barcelona, and like they were literally going, you know, if you put a kit man in charge, would it make that much of a difference to win percentage? Because United are so massive. It's a point I made in the piece at the weekend, but They're so insulated by wealth, there's only so far they can drop. And it does feel as if that's a little bit what's happening here. But from everything you hear within the club, there's absolutely no move to move them on. This is a longer-term project. They're gonna keep their heads.
He wasn't helped last night, Miguel, by the fact that they have injury problems in midfield. Pogba and McTominay are both missing. But like the result at half-time, you could have almost predicted pre-match the second you looked at that team and how attacking it was and how weak it was in midfield. And I know you were writing today about Manchester City's tactical setup and dropping Bernardo Silva in as a false nine. There never really seemed to be any sense of that United team of some great big tactical plan to take on Manchester City, that he had thought this out, that this more attacking midfield would somehow counteract some sort of weakness in the City defence.
Well, it was my colleague Mark Critchley, our Northern correspondent. He was at United's press conference on Tuesday, and he was going on about how Solskjaer was saying we'll have to do something different to the December game because Pep will have something up his sleeve. Pep did have something up his sleeve, but Solskjaer didn't. And that's because he only really seems to have one idea of how to play, and it's not that full an idea. And it basically seems to be based entirely on being able to react to the opposition and what he would call direct, fast attacking. And that like became painfully clear for the embarrassing third goal, really, when suddenly Lindelof and they were inexplicably in the City half, completely exposing the defence and leading to that situation where Jones was so easily turned by De Bruyne. And like I think you're right. You can go through mismatches all over the pitch, and you keep looking around every area, two squads comparing them, but the biggest mismatch is ultimately on the bench. Which is, on one side you have maybe the greatest manager in the game at the moment, one of the greatest of all time, certainly one of the most influential of all time. Then on the other side, a manager whose only experience in England was getting Cardiff relegated and then watching him plummet again in the championship before he was sacked, and his only experience outside that being league titles with a club that was financially well funded in Europe's 23rd ranked league at the time. It's actually, when you stand back, it's remarkable. And, you know, again, there is certain sympathy for Solskjaer because he's in a very difficult situation. There are problems way beyond him. But his very appointment and ongoing employment feels like another reflection of those problems. Everyone in the game talks about it, and everyone in the game seems to be able to see it, bar United. And I mean, you know, who knows? In 3 years, we could all be really eating our words, and the clips like this could be replayed. But if that's the case, it'll be an awful lot of people may eat their words, because there's not much sign of anything at the moment.
The issue here at the moment is that you suspect Manchester United went into the post-Ferguson era with the best of intentions, and to their own horror, they got rid of David Moyes so quickly. And then they have absolutely and thoroughly become just like any other club who chops and changes managers far too often. And it seems like they reached a point ahead of the Solskjaer appointment where they came to the conclusion that they had spent far too much money. Every manager had spent that money in a very different way, and the whole thing was counterintuitive and not working, and really they were becoming everything they were determined not to become. So whoever the next man in was, and lucky for Solskjaer it seems to be him, I think that manager was going to get a huge degree of support, and the club are just so reticent to go back to the chopping and changing and spending another 900 million. You know, Van Gaal's approach, and then Moyes' approach, and then Jose Mourinho's approach. So I'm not surprised to hear that they're keeping their heads. I think that they feel that's the best route forward. And you know, people like Gary Neville have strong public support, and Neville has made the point, like on several occasions, that this is the only way forward for Manchester United. That they have to actually stick to a course. They can't just keep chopping and changing. So I'm not surprised to hear that they are sticking with Solskjaer. I don't anticipate that changing, actually, unless something goes disastrously wrong between now and the end of the season.
Yeah, I'd agree with you, especially because the pattern has basically been so stop-start. There's a certain, I think, again, insulated by their finances, there's a certain capability just to kind of get enough results all the time. And I kind of maybe be fortunate this weekend that rather than being Liverpool, which is the following weekend's match, it's at home to Norwich, a team that will come at them and allow them to play, and a pretty weak team, if a well-coached side as well. But as regards kind of sticking the course, I mean, that's all well and good, but what if the course is wrong? And I think this is what it keeps coming back to at United, is that even sticking the course, it doesn't actually feel like a really well-thought-through, foundations-laid plan. It's like everything else since Ferguson, it's been a direct reaction to what went before. And that seems to be the case. Everything at the club is so reactive, rather than proactively sitting down and coming up with a proper course forward. So obviously, they had Ferguson, and he basically anointed Moyes. Van Gaal was a complete reaction to Moyes, because they went from a novice to someone who'd done it at every level. Mourinho then was a reaction to Van Gaal, or as much a reaction to Man City getting Guardiola. And now Solskjaer is a reaction to Mourinho. All these different profiles of managers, and even Solskjaer's very appointment, given his short-term run, was they were reacting to circumstances rather than thinking about it more deeply. And again, that applies to transfer as well. Only 2 years ago, they were pumping all these money into big names. Now it's the opposite, and they have this kind of, I think it's quite a worrying tendency that they're trying to go for a lot of English homegrown players, players developed in England, and particularly English nationality players, when the price on them has never been higher, and a lot of those players are reticent about going to United right now. And I mean, I think they have improved a lot in kind of scouting and recruitment, but there are questions about the exact level of targets they've got in that regard. And even this January, I've heard, they're crying out for some sort of individual creativity, because they don't really have collective creativity in the absence of Paul Pogba. And they were thinking about Ruben Neves, but apparently he has no interest in going. And right now, one of their solutions, because they obviously want James Maddison for the summer, but they're not going to get him mid-season. So they're apparently looking at some loan deals, which right, kind of sums up the situation a bit.
Yeah, it does a bit. And what is the Pogba situation exactly as you understand it?
Well, I mean, as we can see from his very conspicuous Instagram photos, he's making it clear, yes, the surgery is real. This isn't a concocted story. I think that we can't take that on face value, of course. It's absolutely true. He's not been fit. I think he does deserve some sympathy there, even if he hasn't helped himself with some of his social media profile, always looking like he's active. But everyone knows the underlying story, which is if he had his way, he wouldn't get Manchester United, and he has concerns about the direction of the club. But he might have kind of made a rod for his own back as well, in that he's probably he's a difficult player for anyone to sign. And if he's not performing regularly or at the top level, no one, not even Real Madrid, or especially not Real Madrid, given they've become a bit more intelligent with their finances, they're not going to pay the price United would want for a player like that, whether he's performing or not.
Who are the strong voices in that United dressing room at the moment then? Like, you don't hear too many interviews of, you know, aside from the bog standard, it's not good enough for the Manchester United way, but like obviously there's no Roy Keane coming out slating his teammates. But who are the strong voices that actually, when things have been going horribly wrong, would stand up and lead that group?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, one of the biggest, Ashley Young, could well be on his way to Inter Milan. And he's one of the few in that team now who's actually got some title-winning experience, but doesn't necessarily have a role in the team anymore. Matic is another. But yeah, it's not the most abrasive dressing room. And even from talking to people at the club, this is another issue where it's not quite Pogba's a toxic influence or anything like that. But even some of his maybe antics on social media, or some of the stuff maybe that Lingard does, not that it's inherently bad, but given the optics that there's no one in that dressing room or no one around the club telling them basically, look, lads, just rein it in a bit, that to have a little bit more measure. And I think it's quite an indulged dressing room. I mean, one of the lines I heard in December, when just before, to be fair, they did have that run where they beat Spurs and City, and there was so much talk of whether, right, this is time for Pochettino. But one of the lines I heard was, all the players really like Solskjaer, but the question was, do they like him because they love him, basically? And it isn't as hard as Mourinho was. Although both are obviously extremes and not necessarily positive extremes.
Mm. It was interesting looking at the comments of De Bruyne after the game last night, where he was talking about how City had gone about their business, because it was a very different game to the one at the Etihad back in December. And he was talking about the false nine, and he said, we did 15 minutes on it this morning, that's about it. He said, but to be fair, it's not like we never did it before. We do it sometimes against teams that prefer to play man against man. Cardiff, United, in Barcelona away, we did it the first year with Pep, so we've done it a few times. Bernardo dropped to make it 4-3 in midfield, so they have to choose what to do. If they put their defender up, there's more space behind, and if not, Bernardo's going to be free, and that's what we try to do. I mean, it's a nice tactic, and certainly it's effective. And when you've got midfield players that Manchester City have, it can be very effective. But equally, from Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's point of view, it's not rocket science to figure out how to match up against four midfielders if you need to.
Well, yeah, completely. But then, again, even what De Bruyne is saying there, I mean, he referred to only 15 minutes. But that's 15 minutes that comes from basically a good three seasons of really deep work. I mean, I think on this show we've talked about the way Pep coaches this team, which is basically, before anything else, he tells them, like, you know, you're going to forget everything about football. It's going to be turned on its head. And he gets them to kind of memorize mental maps of the pitch divided into 18 zones. So I think one of the reasons why he initially struggled out for a season, because all these players are kind of getting used to these moves where they had to memorize where the ball, the opposition and their teammates were in relation to play. And I mean, what we're talking about now, that sounds like it's a lot of homework, even for kind of laymen like us. You compare that to the way Manchester United's football is going, I mean, it's levels beyond. And I think, and this is the difference it comes down to. I mean, and this is like a super club level, which is what these are, which is what Liverpool have become under Klopp. This is the sophistication of how these teams go about things. And United are just well short of that. So even when they try and counteract it, it's always like they're a few steps behind, and everything they do is reactive. And it's why, I mean, they're never really going to dominate a game against City anymore if this persists.
It's still insanity when you think about it that they gave Solskjaer this job. That one of, if not the biggest clubs in the world, didn't go around, find the best new talent. Like, as Miguel says, there's coaches out there miles behind what Solskjaer is capable of. Even if it was Nagelsmann, young, innovative coach, that you could say, all right, there's a plan here, there's thought put into this. Yeah. Thomas Tuchel, people like this, rather than just, well, he's managed and he's played for us. It was always going to come back to bite them in the ass. Mm. And the fact that it's just going to roll on, it feels, for another 6 months. And is there a natural end at the end of the season? Like, if they finish sixth, is there just some sort of natural finish and they go, okay, let's move on, let's get a new manager? Or do you feel, Miguel, like it needs one moment that we were talking about at halftime, if this finishes 6 or 7-0, that there'll be one moment and they'll decide enough is enough. Maybe it comes at Anfield in in 10 days' time? Or will there almost be a gentlemanly handshake at the end of the season and think, you know what, you've got us as far as you could, let's move on?
I think the latter is at least some way possible. For it to be, I'd still be currently somewhat doubtful, because there's a sense he's just about doing enough. Because one of the kind of bigger discussions at United is basically he's going to bring all these kids through, and hopefully they'll mesh with kind of, you know, promising signings over the next 2-3 windows. And then in 2-3 years, they'll have kind of a force again. I think it's a very optimistic outlook. This is what I keep coming back to with Solskjaer. Really, it's even a bit frustrating listening to him. It feels like it's all the token replications of what United are supposed to be, direct football, kids, rather than them being kind of unified parts of an overall plan. It just like feels also tokenistic. And even bringing the kids through with some really talented players like Williams and Greenwood, it already, and James as well, there's just too much onus on them rather than back. I mean, you know, I think this isn't maybe the most original point, but for all people go on about, you know, you can't win anything with kids in 95, 96, all of that class 92 generation, Giggs, Beckham, the Nevilles, Butts, Scholes, they came into a team with proper senior figures like Cantona, like Bruce, like Schmeichel, even Keane, although he's that bit younger, but it was, of course, a massive personality. Where, to go back to what you said about kind of voice in this dressing room, There isn't really that about United. And it just feels like the absence. And then again, at the end of his press conference last night, Solskjaer goes on about, you know, there's a mountain to climb, we've climbed them before. And there was some typical reference to, oh, we've had comebacks to this team, this club before. And it just all rings so hollow.
Even his shy shooting down of Van Persie, where he said he took my number, the number of my jersey, but that's all he's going to take. I didn't really know what that meant. Like, what was Robin Van Persie threatening to take? So nothing's quite landing at the moment. That said, he doesn't appear to be out of his mind stressed. He doesn't look like a dead man walking when I see him do post-match interviews. He seems to be handling the scrutiny and the attention reasonably well, would you say?
I mean, from that perspective, you could say that there's actually, the club maybe deserve a certain credit there, but they're not, obviously there's some sort of, there's the framework behind the scenes is that they've actually radiated a composure and they've reassured him, don't worry about the noise, just keep on track.
Yeah.
Because I think you're right. It's not like he's cracking up, as was said about a decade ago about another manager. And from that perspective, I suppose, yeah, I'll give United credit there. And I think there are elements of what they want to do that are productive, but it just feels like the actual key football plan and how much Solskjaer himself articulates that is missing. And it is just I can't get my head around this. Why they, even if it turns out to be a massive success, you'd vindicate everything. But the risk inherent to that, when you're sticking with a manager of Solskjaer's pedigree against a very available manager like Pochettino's pedigree, and especially given the noise they're gathering, that City are already looking to Pochettino as a potential successor to Guardiola for whenever he goes. And they could really miss the boat again there.
Yeah, you talked about how they've become incredibly reactionary, and it is a reactive loyalty. I think they are just so scarred by the way the post-Ferguson era has gone that they have decided now that, you mentioned the token traditions of the club, and they, you know, Manchester United celebrated their loyalty to Ferguson, although, you know, it was hardly the greatest test of commitment when he was the most successful manager in British football. But they have, as a club, certainly put forward the general theory, anyway, that they are loyal to their managers and they give their managers time. And what's happened over the last couple of years would feel like a betrayal of that. So it does really seem to me like they have decided that no matter what, we're sticking with this guy. And it's based more on grasping for those traditions than a realistic belief in Solskjaer's talents. But it's wouldn't, like, how terrible will it have to get for them to see the light here? Pretty terrible, I would venture.
That's why I have a slight, how to put this, because the pattern's gone back and forth all season. Mm. But I think there is maybe the slight danger of unravelling this January, because I wrote this today basically. It's only a week ago, they're going into that Arsenal game on the back of two wins. They haven't even had three consecutive wins in the league since Solskjaer's first run on the job. So that's 10 months now, which is incredible, really. They've been that stop start. And so it looked like they were going into the Arsenal team against an Arsenal side that hadn't won a game under Arteta, could have been there for the taking, and they just flaked it. And since then, they followed it with this bad performance at Wolves, and now this what was a 3-1 that was really an absolute thrashing against City last night. Now, the way this job has gone, or this regime has gone, if it was pattern, they'll bounce back on Saturday and have another little kind of a jump up, and maybe beat Wolves in the FA Cup before it resets again. But if Saturday does go wrong, say, then you do wonder whether that could be unraveling that it would actually take for Solskjaer to lose his job. Because I think that's what it has to come down to at the moment for them to be significant change. It would have to be a really profoundly bad run, one of those kind of beyond point to no return situations. But to be fair, it doesn't seem to be that yet.
It is insane how accepting we are of how far they've fallen.
Yeah.
They've won 8 of 21 matches in the Premier League. Mm. They're 27 points behind Liverpool. And still there's a feeling that they're just on the edge of the cliff, that they manage to claw themselves back just about every time. And just as you think it's all about to fall apart, they'll get those couple of wins. Yet still, it's 8 wins and we're past the halfway point of the season.
I think in spite of the financial insulation that they have, as Miguel rightly says, Solskjaer's greatest trick actually has been to put all these young players in and to almost present themselves as plucky underdogs.
Yeah. Well, it's always the classic Mourinho argument, isn't it? If you want to kind of buy yourself time, throw in some kids. Mm. And there's a little bit of a Lampard at Chelsea. But, you know, as you put it there, what's almost so damning about it is just how unbothered City were by really destroying them. I mean, on the way up to the game yesterday, I was reading a few articles about the kind of history, and I was reading the piece on Carlos Tevez in The Athletic, which obviously was when City were really on the rise, and just how massive United were in City's psychology. And of course, when early on in the game last night, City started singing that chant they have, it's only 5-1, it's only 5-1, in reference to the 6-1. It could have been 10, it could have been 10. And like, obviously, the absolute relish they felt that day in just destroying United. Whereas last night, you know, they didn't even need to bother. Like, this City, a club that has such a neurotic obsession with United for so much of their modern history, and yet then they had the chance really to absolutely batter them last night, and they could just coast instead, which in its own way was almost a worse humiliation, that they don't even take the same pleasure out of destroying United. Mm.
Well, these are interesting times. So their loyalty to him is their badge of honour at the moment, it seems, and I'm not surprised that you've heard through your contacts that they are going to keep their heads and they will almost present this as a sign of an improved new way of doing things at the club. So that is where we are, unless things turn very ugly. Miguel, chief football writer at The Independent, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Cheers, lads. Thank you. Have a good one.
There you are. That's Miguel Delaney. He was speaking to us earlier on this afternoon about the situation at Manchester United. Writes for the London Independent, as you know, I'm sure. The latest at the King Power Stadium. Leicester have hit back against Aston Villa, so it's now 1-1, 79 minutes on the clock. Kelechi Iheanacho with the strike for Leicester about 5 minutes ago. So they have, 12 minutes, Leicester, to grab a winner at home in the first leg of this Carabao Cup semi-final. Aston Villa had been leading from the 28th minute, so Leicester have managed to pull level just in the nick of time. We're going to take a short break. Glenn Whelan's had a rather acrimonious and unexpected end to his time at Hearts. Tom English, chief sports writer with BBC Scotland, will join us and fill us in. We will also get his take on how the title race is set to go down between Celtic and Rangers.
Paddy Power and the Football Show. The greatest football partnership since Diouf and Heskey.
Now then, you're welcome back. Still 1-1 at the King Power Stadium, 82 minutes on the clock. Leicester are all over Aston Villa. They are pushing hard for a second. Jamie Vardy has just been in on goal under a bit of pressure, but still got a shot away. It just hit the side netting, so they are pushing hard for a second goal, Leicester, after going 1-0 down this evening. So 1-1 after 82 minutes. Meanwhile, Glenn Whelan. We have Tom English, chief sports writer with BBC Scotland on the line. Evening, Tom.
Good evening, Joe. How are you?
Very well, thanks. Happy New Year. So Glenn Whelan, you know, Glenn Whelan, for much of his career, has defied the odds. Every summer, Stoke tried to buy his replacement and he saw them off one by one. He went to Aston Villa and you thought that would be a big step down or a real winding down of his career, but he played very well from them, was by all accounts a brilliant influence in the dressing room and spearheaded a return to the Premier League. He literally waved goodbye to the Irish crowd and then came back to win more caps, play very well, and is now closing in on 100 caps and is, I'm not quite first name on the team, but not far off it at the moment either. So I didn't really think Hearts would be his undoing, but it's proven, and it seems to have ended in a really acrimonious way. Just tell us, for those of us who haven't, you know, overly followed what's gone on here, he joined Hearts in the summer. I would have thought it would have been smooth sailing, but no.
No, it hasn't been, but it hasn't been smooth sailing for anybody at Hearts. They're having a disastrous season. Hearts, budget-wise, they're the fourth biggest club in Scotland, and they're now 5 points adrift at the bottom of the league. They've got rid of their manager, Craig Levein. They've got rid of coaches. Daniel Stendel has come in now, the German who was last seen at Barnsley. He's the manager, and he's come in and he's had a look around for the last three or four games. And yesterday, he not only got rid of Glenn Whelan, but he also got rid of his captain, Christoph Berra.
Yeah.
He relegated Berra to training with the youth team. And he told Glenn Whelan that he was no longer required. So I don't think any of this should come as a surprise. The team is playing appallingly. Whelan had a good start with Hearts. He came in, played well, looked hungry, was having an influence. Yeah. Fans liked him. And, you know, talking to some Hearts people today and a couple of other people around the club, they all felt that his heart wasn't quite in it. But that he was getting by, playing okay. And then when Republic of Ireland played Denmark, after that, it's been 7 games that Hearts have played since that game. And he hasn't looked the same player as he did before. He's looked, according to them, has looked disinterested, hasn't mixed with the other players that much, has built no relationship with the youth players around the club. Some of the youth players say, I don't think he even knows my name. So he hasn't invested, according to the fans and according to some people around the club, in the club the way they hoped he would. And I can tell you, if you look at the Hearts club forum, and I've a number of Hearts pals of mine, not one person is sorry to see him go. Not one.
Okay. Kind of surprising, because he's always been talked about as a model pro. Even Stephen Elliott was on the show today talking to Phil Egan, our colleague, and he was just again reiterating that wherever Whelan has gone, he's been seen as a real leader and a force for good in the dressing room. So it's at odds, those reports, with a very long and distinguished career.
Absolutely. I mean, I thought when he came in at Hearts, I thought he would be that senior pro sitting in the middle of the park, having a good influence. There's a lot of young players around the Hearts Academy is quite good. There's a lot of young players in and around the place. I thought he'd be a good fit. And he was, to begin with. But I think everybody has been ground down by the Hearts debacle this season. Skin and hair has been flying around that club all season.
Okay.
And I think Whelan has probably been caught up with it. Maybe he's been ground down by the lack of quality around him. Maybe he's been demoralised by the lack of quality around him. But something has gone wrong because Daniel Stendel has come in, he's had a look at him, and he clearly doesn't fancy him. And you can argue that he was done in a brutal way, a disrespectful way. But Stendel, from his part, sees the team, they're on a massive losing run, and he needs to do something dramatic because doing the same thing is going to get them relegated.
Glenn Whelan, and this is not his usual way either, has spoken to the media at length today. Aidan Fitzmaurice is on the Independent website if people want to read the story. And the quotes are, well, certainly from Glenn Whelan's point of view, I would say damning of Daniel Stendel as opposed to the other way around. It feels like I've been thrown under a bus, is his summation of how he feels about his Hearts exit. He talked about Stendel arriving at the club and pretty much from the off having a go at Whelan. In training, he said, I think he did things to show the other players, especially the younger players, that he was the boss. He was nitpicking with things I was doing in training. He said, I feel let down. The way my name is out there now, it feels like I've been thrown under a bus. He said he played in 8 home games. He got 5 Man of the Match awards. Is that right?
Look, Joe, I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, I can remember 3 games. Certainly the Hibs game, he was very good and clearly the man of the match. They won that game.
Okay, well, we won't quibble over the
number. Maybe another couple too.
Yeah.
I struggled to get to 5.
Let's say he played well, but he says within days, in the piece it says here, Stendel had a pop at Whelan in the media. This is days of a Celtic match. They were 2-0 down when Whelan was brought on. So as Glenn Whelan said, it was hardly my fault we lost that game. And at some point after the loss to Celtic, Stendel was asked about experienced players in the team. He said experienced players like Whelan cannot handle the situation at the moment. He was asked if Whelan had leadership qualities And Stendhal said, a real leader in the centre of the pitch. Sorry, maybe I missed it. So, I, like, incredibly damning stuff. And in Whelan's view, this guy came in and had a go at him pretty much from the off, and the chemistry was wrong. And then even on Christmas Day, a text arrives at 9:10 in the evening on Christmas Day to let Whelan know he's not needed for the game the next day. And I'm sure if Whelan had a bit more advance notice, he might have had different Christmas Day plans, you can imagine. So that didn't seem like the best treatment of an experienced pro. You mentioned the Beira situation as well. Is this just down to the fact that these two lads are probably picking up decent wages? Like, this just all seems very strange.
Well, it certainly Beira would be picking up decent wages, but it's been obvious for months and months that Christophe Beira is way past his best. Okay. He's too slow. Daniel Stendhal wants to play a high press, high energy, loads of energy around the park. Wants to play the high press. Christophe Beira can't play that. Mm. He just can't play it. He's not mobile enough. And I think Glenn Whelan falls into the same category. He's not Daniel Stendhal's type of player.
Right.
And you know, the exits for both of them were pretty savage, no question. Beira has more grounds, I think, for complaint than Whelan has, because Whelan is just in the door. Beira has been a long-term servant there for a couple of different stints. He was a club captain.
Right.
And he was told, listen, go off and play with the youth team. We don't want you in the senior squad anymore. Now, that is brutal. But it just shows you that the club is in a very, very bad place.
Yeah.
Stendhal doesn't like what he sees in the squad. The squad is bloated. There's far too many players and far too many rubbish players there. So I think he feels that the only way to get people out is to be brutal and almost bully them out the door.
Yeah, he's certainly done it. So we'll see if Glenn Whelan picks up another club in January. I'm sure Mick McCarthy hopes he does. Why are Hearts in such disarray? I mean, why is it such a basket case? You mentioned the budget.
Yeah, they've too many players, Joe. I mean, they've been recruiting players left, right and centre for a couple of seasons now. Craig Levein, the previous manager, who was also the director of football, made a complete bags of it. And, you know, this time last year, the club was in a decent place, but they recruited badly, lost confidence, style of play went down the pan, haven't recovered from it. Tynecastle is an unforgiving place. You think of Ibrox and you think of Celtic Park as kind of intimidating grounds. Tynecastle is more intimidating than the two of them when the home team is going badly. It's cruel what the fans do to their own team. So I think its place is kind of suffocating at the moment. And Stendhal knows this. And he wants to bring in youth players. He's brought two youth players back who were on loan, teenagers. So he wants to bring energy and youth into the team. I mean, you know, Glenn Whelan, I think it'll be 36 on Monday.
Yeah.
He doesn't fit the bill anymore at Hearts.
No, he's not the Lord's answer to high-pressing football, in fairness. I think
he's not.
Before we let you go, actually, we're a bit tight for time this evening. Sorry, apologies. The evening got away from us. Part two of the season upcoming, obviously, Rangers won at Celtic just before the break. And on the face of it, we have a title race. But we had something similar this time last year. And in the end, Celtic won comfortably. Is there anything to suggest that Rangers can push them more this time around?
There is, Joe, yeah. I mean, this time last year, Rangers beat Celtic, but they beat them at Ibrox.
Yeah.
Now they've gone to Celtic Park for the first time in knocking on for 10 years, and they've done them at Celtic Park. That's a big shift for a start. This time last year, after beating Celtic at Ibrox, Rangers lost their next game to Kilmarnock. They don't look like a team that are going to lose games to Kilmarnock. In fact, they lost two to Kilmarnock after Christmas last year and drew another one. I think they dropped 15 points or something post-Christmas. They look far more robust now, Rangers. Mm. They look a far more confident team, far mentally stronger than they were a year ago. I thought Gerrard would get drowned in this job. I didn't think he'd be able to handle the enormity of it and the internal pressure of it. But he's proved me wrong. I think he's been exceptional so far. He's a lot of work to do, but they're in a very good place at the moment, Rangers.
Yeah,
and Celtic know it. Yeah. Celtic know it.
I think Gerrard surprised a few of us, really, hasn't he? Because it was fair to assume this was just the signing of a name, the signing of a legend, and it was just hard to see it working out as well as it has. What about Lennon in the midst of all this? Obviously, European football has gone well for Celtic. How's he Has the job he's doing been received by Celtic fans? He seems to have avoided getting involved in any nonsense or controversy this time around as well, I know.
Yeah, he's spoken about this quite a few times, that he's grown up a lot. And he did an interview last week over here, and he was asked, you know, if you could talk to the Neil Lennon of 8 years ago, what would you say? And he'd say, I just say, calm down, son.
Well, we could have all said that to him.
Yeah, I know. Well, we did say it at the time, but he wasn't listening. I think he's doing an excellent job. I think Celtic fans who are very resistant to him, I think I would say the majority resistant to him getting the job permanently, have obviously fallen in love with him again. There was a big blip, obviously, against Rangers at Celtic Park, but the team was flying before that. They're out in Dubai now, having a mid-season break. And I think they'll go again. But this is very interesting now, because I think Lennon and all of the Celtic players know that this Rangers team is probably not going to go away like the Rangers team went away last year. So this is going to be a title fight, I think, to the wire.
Mm. Which is fantastic for you and for all fans of Scottish football. I mean, Jesus, long overdue.
Long overdue. And you'd want all the other clubs in there, Aberdeen, Hearts, Hibs, all in there. But you're not going to get that, because the financial disparity is just too vast. But it's better than, you know, two horses in the race is better than one horse in the race, which has been the case for 8 years.
Do you get the sense, finally, Tom, that Gerrard is a man in a hurry? Could you see him sticking around at Rangers for a couple of years and staying there until he wins a league? Or is he already thinking Premier League, do you suspect, in his mind?
No, I don't think he is thinking Premier League, Joe. I mean, he just signed up for another couple of years there just before Christmas. I think it just shows you the Liverpool thing. He was in there. Once he's in, Gerrard. And he's absolutely shown no sign of a desire to go back to England. Of course, that's where he will go eventually.
Sure.
But he is totally focused on this Rangers job. Looks like he's loving every minute of it. And I don't think he's going to leave unless he wins that title, or if he's asked to leave,
sure,
which is the other side of it. But he is very impressive, and he has it's a huge focus on winning the championship with Rangers.
And I presume he'll be backed financially, or do they have the wherewithal to do that, given their obsession with stopping Celtic reaching a certain magic number?
They have. He's been backed more than most managers in recent times at Rangers. You know, they spent $7 million on Ryan Kent from Liverpool reserves. There's been other players that have come in for money. It's, you know, we're not talking massive money, but in a Scottish context, Joe, we are talking significant cash.
Yeah.
And it's money, and Celtic fans like to obsess about, oh, where's the money coming from? You know, liquidation two is coming up. they're gonna go to the wall again. A lot of the money is soft loans from three or four directors. The pressure is on. There's massive pressure on Rangers to stop the 9 in a row and the 10 in a row.
Mm.
And I think this is their chance. I think if they don't take this chance, I think stopping the 10 in a row is going to prove very, very difficult for them next season, because they've put themselves in a great position. I know they're 2 points behind Celtic, but they have a game in hand against St Johnstone, which they will win.
Mm.
That'll put them 1 point ahead. They've never been that close, really, with a team that looks the part, that has gone to Celtic Park and won. And actually, you could make a strong case that in 5 of the last 6 Old Firm games, Rangers have been the better team. They haven't won them all, but to me, in 5 of the 6, they've looked the better side.
Okay. Listen, Tom, pleasure as ever. Thanks so much.
No problem, Joe.
Cheers. Tom English there, Chief Sports Writer with BBC Scotland.
Paddy Power and the Football Show, the greatest football partnership since Diouf and Heskey.